All right, hello, can you hear me? Good. Hopefully we should have a slide up coming soon to just set us on our ways. I believe this is the last in the series on wisdom, so I hope you're all feeling very wise and know what it is, because I'm not quite sure what I know what it is. So hopefully you can help us out and give us a good. So this is my, I couldn't be bothered doing a proper PowerPoint, so I just did one slide. So this is the verses I'm meant to be talking on, meant in the operative word, and then this is what I'm actually going to be talking on, so different headings I'm going to go through. So if you get bored with what I'm currently saying, you can just look ahead and try and guess what it is I'm going to talk about. But hopefully I should be able to hold your attention. So, wisdom. Are we starting to get a grasp of what it is, of what it means, of what it's like? Perhaps not. Wisdom, it can seem like such a lofty ideal, a goal which is constantly beyond anyone's reach. And in some ways, perhaps that's true. But in many ways, the concept of wisdom within wisdom literature actually goes against this view. Wisdom in wisdom literature is stubbornly practical. It's deeply concerned with what's real. In fact, you might say she's a realist. She is concerned with the everyday and the not so quite the mundane as well as the extraordinary. She's concerned with the individual as well as the communal. She's concerned with the pain, the conflict, the turmoil of it all. Indeed, she takes very seriously our experiences, our perspectives, and our questions of it all. But perhaps more explicitly, what wisdom is utterly concerned with is a relational state of being. I don't know if you have looked at through the different themes which we'll be covering. How many of them speak about how we are in relation to our family, to our work, to our neighbour, you name it. Wisdom literature has something to say about how we are in relation. So it's utterly concerned, so not only who we are for the sake of who we are, but it's concerned with who we are for the sake of the other. And it's concerned with who others are to us as well. So wisdom is complicated. It's perhaps hard to pin down and to see exactly what it is. But I think she has something to say to us. Certainly tonight and certainly through the book of Proverbs. So what is the wisdom about? What is its end goal? So the Hebrew word wisdom is chokmah, which, as ever, the Hebrew is far more nuanced than the English counterpart. So if I was to say what wisdom is about, what its end goal is, it's about the art of living well, the art of living wholesomely, of living healthily. Hence the title, The Art of Living Angrily, since we're talking about anger, and we're taking it from wisdom's perspective. And in fact, it's very clear in the Proverbs, if you look at chapter 1, what her goal is in terms of wisdom. Right then, verse 3, you see, perhaps your translation says skillful living or something to that effect. So that is the goal of wisdom. That is what we are trying to attain as we think, as we deliberate, and as we question over these issues. So with that in mind, with wisdom as the art of living, with wisdom being stubbornly practical in what it's all about, I've got a question for you. We're going to read Proverbs 1, verse 20 to 24. In fact, I might ask someone to read it out for us, just so I can get a drink of water. But I want you to read it with this question in mind. Is wisdom a gift from God, or is it something to be pursued? So somebody would like to read chapter 1, verse 20 to 24.
Responded to my rebuke, I will pour out my heart to you and make my thoughts known to you.
Yeah, you've covered it. It's cool. So, is wisdom a gift from God, or is it something to be sought after? Perhaps not the most obvious in the verses, but I think it's there. Is anybody want to venture a guess? Is anybody wise enough to dare to speak out? Seek it. Yeah? So is it not a gift? Is it not a gift from God? Ah, so both, yes. I think that is what wisdom is about. See, wisdom within all wisdom literature, but particularly I think within the book of Proverbs, is seen to be this paradoxical gift. On the one hand, it's seen as this gift from God, freely given to you with outstretched hands, all wrapped up with a ribbon and all. But on the other hand, and this is where the warnings come in, particularly in kind of the verses which we just read, it's seen as something which you need to wholeheartedly pursue. To be striven for, it's there to be grasped, but we need to grasp it. One of the commentators brings up an old lyric. I don't know it. I think it's from an old song. It's certainly not from my generation. But it's a lyric about love, and it says this. A man chases a girl until the girl catches him. That, in a sense, is what wisdom is like. We chase after it until it catches us. But so why am I going here? I hear you ask. Why has wisdom, as this paradoxical gift, got to do with anger? Well, I think it's an important framework to approach not only the concept of anger within wisdom literature, but really any theme within wisdom literature. The reason being, wisdom, as this paradoxical gift, goes against the very simple understanding that morality, that this elusive art of living well, is simply imposed from above with this rigid structure. You see, wisdom is not about God coming down and laying down the law. Now, I've spoken about kind of the law and its nature in the past before, and I said not even law is to be understood in that manner. And again, Isaac Maxwell has spoken in similar fashion. But even if the law is understood in that fashion, then wisdom literature stands in stark contrast to it. Because wisdom literature is about God standing in the street, inviting us halfway up the mountain to come to meet him and to converse, to have a conversation about what is good, what is true, and about what is beautiful. So are we going to take wisdom literature seriously? Are we just going to read the verses and go, oh, well, that's very straightforward. Do this, don't do that, maybe do this. Nah. No, I mean, the wisdom literature and its challenge is a lot more than that. It's about wrestling with it, wrestling with who God is, wrestling with who God is to this world, wrestling with who God is to us and to this church. So if you don't believe me, then that's what wisdom literature is about. Look at Proverbs chapter 26, verse 4. It says, do not enter a fool according to his folly, lest yourself also be like him. Very straightforward, right? If somebody's talking nonsense, don't indulge him. But then, take a look at the very following verse. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own estimation. Right? On one hand, don't answer a fool according to his folly. On the other, answer a fool according to his folly. So which is it? You could take any one of those verses and quite easily make it into a law. Whatever the circumstances, do this. But wisdom literature refuses to be so strictly bound. If you want to know what wisdom literature is about, just spend a day meditating on these two verses and see what it takes you. You'll either be very wise or you'll go slightly mad, but I think you'll get something out of it. But what's my point? My point is, we just can't simply take these verses and think that if we simply apply them, that we've somehow engaged with wisdom, that we've engaged with who God is and who he is to this world. It takes a lot more than that. It takes for us to wrestle with the very character of God, with his very word and what that means to us as a community of God, and as a community of God in this world. So, with that quite long introduction about what wisdom literature is for me and how I'm kind of viewing and setting this up. Maybe it was about time that we wrestled with the concept of anger. So, in recent times, I think there's been a fairly seismic shift in the kind of cultural understanding of not only anger, but importantly, our entire emotional being and how that relates to self, to our perception of personhood, and to our mind in particular. Largely speaking, from the classical period right up to the modern, Western civilization has always seemed to understand that emotions to be in constant opposition to reason. The two are struggling out to have control of your mind. To be emotional was ultimately seen to be weak. It was seen to be giving in to your more basic and primal desire. On the other hand, to be strong is to oppress, is to suppress that, and to overcome reason, and to overcome with reason, I should say. Recently, however, I think there's been a dramatic change in how people understood our emotional being and how that relates to the self. And this is actually personified very much in Disney's own animation. I've already seen Inside Out, we're going to get there. But before, we need to speak about the forefather of Inside Out. It's a 1943 short animation, about 8 minutes long, called, very aptly, Reason and Emotion. Now, this is a kind of a World War II propaganda piece, and its desire was to encourage the American public in World War II and to warn them against the fear-mongering tactics of the Axis powers during that time. But its message was very clear. Your emotions, your imaginations are not to be out of control. You have to keep them in line with good old-fashioned reason. In other words, your head is very much to rule your heart. Now, this short propagandist is the main reference point, actually, for Inside Out. If it's on YouTube, you can Google it, Reason and Emotion, 1943, it'll probably come up, and you'll see that it's very much the basis of the concept of Inside Out. However, Inside Out's understanding of the inner workings of the mind is slightly more nuanced than that. In short, if you haven't seen it, the film Inside Out follows 11-year-old girl called Riley on her emotional journey as she moves from one side of America to the other. But more centrally, what the story focuses on, is how five emotions, joy, the leader, sadness, fear, disgust, and anger, balance the control of her mind from inside a mission-like headquarters. Now, slight spoiler alert, but the turning point of the film comes when Joy realizes that sadness is not only useful, but essential to the harmonious well-being of who Riley is as a person, and even to the overall state of her happiness. Now, emotions in a post-40s world, and even the so-called negative emotions of fear, of anger, and of sadness, are not seen to be repressed and to be controlled by and mastered by reason, but rather they seem to be embraced. There's a need to feel what needs to be felt. That, in essence, is what the film Inside Out is all about. Now, if you're reacting strongly against that, you're probably very modern in your thinking. If you're thinking, that sounds great, you're probably a bit more postmodern, if you're wondering where you lie on the spectrum. Now, actually, I think the Hebraic understanding of self is actually far more in tune with the Inside Outs rather than its 1943 forefather. You see, the Hebrew language, when it speaks about the self, is not quite so dualistic in its understanding. It doesn't put the head against the heart. When the Hebrew language speaks of the heart, it's speaking about your whole self. It's speaking about your intellect, your emotions, and also your spiritual self. So, are emotions to be mastered, or need to be embraced? Is anger to be mastered, or is it to be embraced? But even as I say that, and if you're looking and reading these verses, you can't help but notice that there's not a lot of positive verses about anger there, is there? In fact, it's probably not even a neutral verse about anger. They're all warnings and angers at
about the dangers of it.
And so that's why I feel compelled to not simply look at Proverbs, but to also think more theologically and reflect on the theological concept of anger. So we'll start in Proverbs, then we'll move onto more theological grounds as we reflect on what God is in terms of anger and how that might reflect in who we are in terms of anger. So, if you look at these verses, now you'll see that there's quite a wide theme of them. Some of them talk about anger, some of them about wrath, some of them about hatred. Let's not get into what's the difference between anger and hatred. We don't have time for that tonight. Some of them speak about how we speak when we are angry. Some of them speak about how our words can stir up anger. So there's a whole lot going on there. But I think there is one theme which we need to ground or and be the anchor point of how we approach how Proverbs as a whole speaks of anger and how theologically we have to reflect how what anger is. So in the three verses I think we need to focus on. Those are Proverbs chapter 15, verse 18. A quick-tempered person stirs up dissension, but one who is slow to anger comes a quarrel. Proverbs 16:32, better to be slow to anger than a mighty warrior, and one who controls his temper is better than the one who captures a city. Proverbs 19:11, a person's wisdom makes him slow to anger, and is his glory to overlook an offence. And what's the commonality between those ones? Slow to anger. Now we've just sung a song about it quite recently. Because when the Bible speaks about slow to anger, it's not simply asking us to be slow to anger, but it's actually one of the main confessions about who God is. Where God is gracious and compassionate and slow to anger. In fact, that is probably part of the most repeated declaration about who God is and his character throughout the Old Testament. You see it time and time and time again throughout, right at the beginning in Exodus, through and forth throughout the Psalms, and even into the wisdom literature, as we see now. So, it would seem that Proverbs is saying that who we are to be in our anger is to be reflective of who God is in his anger. So if God is slow to anger, we are to be slow to anger. So the first utterance of that phrase comes in Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in loyal love and faithfulness. Now, it's not insignificant that the first time we come across this is in the Exodus narrative, because that is to write the beginning of the story between God and Israel. And so this is Israel's core testimony of who God is. God is compassionate, he is gracious, he is slow to anger. And so this happens at the very point of the covenant between Israel and God. Now the Hebrew word for covenant is bereshit. It literally means to bind. So as God binds himself to his people, as he dwells with them, as he absolutely decides to self-invest in these people. This is a declaration which is said again and again. He is compassionate. He is slow to anger. He is gracious. And actually, if you think about the history of who Israel is to God and how God is to Israel, it's not surprising that this is the core testimony that they keep repeating. I mean, think about it. How many times has Israel decided to go their own way? How many times did Israel decide that, actually, God's way isn't our way? How many times did he say, quite stubbornly, that we know better, we can go this way? How many times was she unfaithful? How many times did she forget that she was in slavery in Egypt and decided to enslave and to oppress people? How many times did she forget to take seriously the calling to take care of the vulnerable amidst her, of the orphan, of the foreigner, and of the widow? How many times did she take pride in her calling and seeing herself to be better than all the nations around her? And yet, despite these numerous feelings, which we can probably turn to any Old Testament narrative and see one of them, God continues to be slow to anger. And I think this is because God has bound himself to Israel. He is actually committed to who they are, which necessitates that he is slow to anger. Because he is invested in them. He is caring for them. He is wanting for them to come to fruition. And so he is slow in his anger. He doesn't come in wrath and judgment. But he is slow. He is relational. No, I think Israel's particular example of who God is to them is always meant to be seen to be mirrored of who God is to creation. So that God has committed and bound himself to Israel is also mirrored in the fact that God has committed and bound himself to creation as a whole. And so as God loves and bears of the chaos of who Israel is, God loves and bears of the chaos of creation. And he is slow to anger. So, how do we emulate God's anger? What is the art of living angrily? Well, as Proverbs says, part of the answer is that we be slow into anger. We are to love, we are to self-invest in one another for the sake of the other. Within church, but perhaps most challenging of all, beyond these walls, to the community and society around us. And above all, to be slow to anger is really to bear of the chaos and the turmoil of it all. But there's always a big theological but somewhere, isn't there? To be slow to anger doesn't mean that anger does not exist. The work may be very long, but it has an end, and there's something at the end of it. And actually, if you look at Exodus 34, the very first declaration that God is slow to anger, 34 verse chapter 6 and chapter 7, it's a warning against judgment. So the two seem to go hand in hand in some way. How does this work? Now, there's a heck of a lot of theological baggage and work we need to go through when we're thinking about anger, about wrath, and about God's judgment, and I really don't have the time or the want to go into it at this minute. But I'll leave you with this. For me, it's utterly important that that which makes God slow to anger is also that which makes God angry. Sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? How can the thing that makes God slow to anger also be the thing which makes God angry? Well, I think, again, it's God's commitment. It's God's self-investment. It's God binding himself not only to his people but to creation. Because he's not willing to bear off the chaos of it all. He's also investing to see it come into fruition. He's investing in its utter and complete well-being. And so, when creation has been self-destructive, when there's oppression, when there's anger, when there's hurt, how can God not get angry when his creation has been destructive? There you go. So why does God get angry? Well, I think the primary reason for God acting out in anger is in the face of systematic oppression and abuse, both of people and of creation. We could look at a number of Old Testament passages, particularly in the prophets, which speak again and again of these kind of themes. But most vividly, and I think most poignantly, we see this very much encapsulated and embodied within the person of who Jesus is. After all, we're talking about wisdom. Jesus is seen as the very portrayal, not only of the embodiment of wisdom within Christian tradition, but also within the Gospels. John starts his Gospel, "The Word was made flesh." He's very much mirroring chapter 8 here in Proverbs. In fact, probably one of the only reasons he didn't use the Greek Sophia for wisdom is that it's female in gender rather than word is male. So what does Jesus have to say about wisdom and how to live angrily and how to live well in our anger? Well, Andrew's already kind of touched briefly on one of the passages. It's John chapter 2. Now, there's quite a few passages, actually, when Jesus gets angry. One quite funny one is when he gets angry at a fig tree. for, you know, quite randomly, but most famously, and most, I think, relevant to us tonight, is the ordeal in the temple. Now, every single gospel picks up this story, which probably gives you a hint of its significance and its importance. But I think John brings out the best of it. John puts it at prime importance. Well, the synoptic gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke all put this narrative towards the end of Jesus' ministry. But John takes it and he brings it right to the front. He brings it at the very start of John's ministry, of Jesus' ministry, sorry, right into chapter 2. He gives it central place. Now, if you read the narrative from the very start in John's Gospel, Jerusalem is seen as this place of not only of importance, but it's seen as this place of power. It's this capital city. And we're told within this narrative that it's the Passover as well, which means people from all over the place coming to Jerusalem for the festival, and more specifically, coming to the temple. But instead of finding the free grace of God, which you might expect as they come to the temple, what do they find? They find those in power are abusing their privilege. They are systematically oppressing, particularly economically within the Gospel of John, which is, I think, his main highlight, those who are vulnerable and in vulnerable positions. And I think that is what Jesus gets so angry about. It's the systemic economic abuse of those who should actually know better. And worse than all of that is not simply that they're abusing it, but they are abusing it in the name of God. And therefore, what does he say? How dare you turn my father's house into a marketplace? So, is this just a temple tantrum of God, of Jesus just acting out? Or is this really showing an embodiment of what to live angrily in some senses? What do we learn? If Jesus is the embodiment of wisdom, what has he to teach us about anger? So, we've covered quite a lot of ground and many different themes, and from all over, from Exodus right up to Jesus and John's Gospel. So what is the art of living angrily? Are we to master our anger? Are we to embrace it? Well, perhaps embracing is a strong word. After all, we are all very aware of the destruction that anger can bring. And I don't think anybody, and I don't think even the postmodern sense of embracing your emotive self, is quite advocating for that. But I think what we should realise is that it's not there to be suppressed by reason and to be bottled down, but rather it is to be seen to be a legitimate and at times a right emotional reaction. To blindly suppress doesn't really bring you self-control. What it really brings is apathy. There are certain things which we should absolutely get angry about, because quite frankly, God gets angry about certain things. And I think it's God's anger that we should embrace, the kind of anger that speaks out against this systemic abuse and oppression, the kind of anger born from a commitment and a care for creation and for the other, the kind of anger, in short, that is born out of empathy for others. Allow me to propose maybe a new lens of how we might be able to think about anger and what it means to live well in anger. And this is the lens of what not should we act out in anger, or should we not, or what is anger good or beneficial, and all these kind of questions. But rather, the lens is this. Is my acting out in anger constructive or deconstructive? Or destructive, as I've put on the slide, actually. And we've all experienced the structure of anger. We've all partaken of it. We've all been in the kind of anger which cuts off, which stalls, and even ends kind of relationship. It's the kind of anger which usually has its own self-interest at heart, I think. Most probably it's pride. That's usually the very victim of the kind of destructive kind of anger. It's quick to speak and perhaps slow to forgive. Structural anger has probably vengeance not justice, as it seems. And most definitely, destructive anger is the very kind of anger which Proverbs is speaking against. Proverbs is begging us to bear in love, to bear with the chaos of it all, not to act out, to be slow in our anger, to think of how we speak when we're angry, to think about the effect that our words have. So to be wise, sometimes, is not to act, but to bear off the chaos of it all. But there's also, I think, constructive anger, which stands in contrast to this. Constructive anger is the kind of anger which seeks to mend the broken relationships which surround it. It's the kind of anger that primarily is born of empathy, that has the other, the outcast, the outsider, as its main interest. It may be reactionary. Jesus' reaction seems to be quite reactionary in the Gospels, but although I think he probably would have heard of kind of the ongoings going in the temple court at the time, so I don't think it was a complete shock to him what was happening, but I think to be affronted in such a way certainly elicited this reaction. But usually I think constructive anger is considerate. It's slow in its build-up. It ponders why it's angry and the reason it is. It decides, when is it right to speak out and what words should I use? And are those words going to be constructive? Are they going to bring about the well-being of the people around me and of those I speak out? Constructive anger has for its aim its justice, not vengeance. And it wants to bring about the well-being of all creation around it. So to be wise and to live angrily sometimes is to speak out in anger. So what is this art of being angry I'm talking about? Well, I think the wisdom that we are to try and grasp tonight is to hold this tension between bearing in love and speaking out in love. It's to wrestle with God with which is the right path and which is the right one to go. Do we speak or do we not speak? Do we bear with the chaos and the turmoil of the world around us or do we speak against it? And that, I think, is where wisdom comes in. And it's not so easy as to read these verses and decide, well, in this circumstance this, in this circumstance that. No, it demands for us to wrestle with who God is, to wrestle with what the world is like, and to see for what it is, a broken world of oppression with all sorts of systemic abuses surrounding it. So, I don't know if this is helpful or challenging or somewhere between, but I'll leave you with just one last quote from another guy who knew something about wisdom, although this time not from the Hebraic tradition, but from the Greek tradition. It's Aristotle himself. Anyone can get angry, but to do this to the right person, to the right extent, at the right time, with the right motive, in the right way, that is not for everyone, nor is it easy. Thank you.